average age in build for rent communities is 43 years old. One question we get on every one of these deals that we work on is, this seems like it's in the middle of nowhere.
These all seem to me like a financing mechanism. The land here's probably not worth much. I think the moat with these kind of products is next to nothing.
Why do people want to live here in this submarket?
I firmly believe that the vast majority of groups buying build for rent today want to convince themselves that they're buying at some level of discount. Welcome to this week's edition of Real Estate Anonymous. We're going to talk about build for rent opportunity outside of Savannah, Georgia. We haven't talked about the build for rent space thus far on the podcast. And so we'll unpack some of the nuances in the build for rent industry, and we'll jump to the end here. Unfortunately, we don't have any buyers on this from the co-host, but hope you enjoy, and we'll look forward to picking it up next week.
Today's podcast sponsor is RE Cost Seg, the premier provider of cost segregation studies founded by my friend Mitchell Baldridge. Are hefty tax bills eating into your real estate income? RE Cost Seg can help you save significantly on taxes and increase cash flow. Their expert engineers uncover opportunities for accelerated depreciation, delivering accelerated tax savings and valuable insights. With over $225 million in tax savings for clients, they're here to support investors of all levels and sizes. Visit recostseg.com/REAPOD for a free proposal and start saving today.
So I was telling Brett, because Brett's not on Twitter, I was telling him about the unwashed masses who are furious with me that I would ask a financial analyst candidate to do a modeling test. Brett, it went viral. I mean, right. I don't know how much I can take a look in. I had to mute all the replies. Yeah. Let's see. Yeah. 7, almost 8 million views, 1500 comments from people. And it was a mix of 10% of the people who were sending me DMs and commenting were either saying, yeah, this is sort of normal for finance. You do a modeling test to like show that you have the necessary skills to do the job. But that was the minority. The bulk of people were telling me, you're a Nazi. You're a wannabe slave owner. You should yourself. It was just the most deranged. And it's still getting direct messages from people telling me, like, I hope. What? They're like, no. People were saying, no unpaid labor.
What are we talking about here?
What are you talking about? What am I going to do with this work product? Do you think I want some kid who's 2 years out of college, like he's going to come with some genius idea and I'm having him work for free? Like, I know the answers to the test. I made the test. There's not like some predatory. Let's see. I got another message here. What's this one? One pending request. Yeah.
How many applicants
do you ever respond with one? You really feel?
You know what? Yeah. I got probably a dozen kids who were like, I'd love to see your modeling test. I'll smash it. I'm looking for an analyst job. Like it's not meant to be a long thing, but I don't know how else you're supposed to evaluate the technical skills of the job. Like I can't just interview Eric and I say, are you good at financial modeling? And he says, yep. And I say, well, good enough for me. You know, like you have to, there's got to be some baseline way to understand if Eric can do a couple of things that are necessary to do. And I really don't give a shit if Eric gets the answers correct. That's not it. It's, I want to understand, can you work an Excel model? And what is your thought process behind arriving at the answers you arrived at? But yeah, these people were like, how dare you scam
it's not
free
a real
work
deal.
Off people?
It's like, it's a make-believe deal.
Anyway, I'm sorry. Yeah, right. It's a make-believe deal. I know the answers to the test. I thank you. Right? Yeah. Everyone thought the tweet was very much about them. So it's been an interesting 24 hours. I was going to do something to promote the pod, but I'm like not wanting to give the bottom 10% of the world a new target. So I'm going to leave
social media.
That's really been a big change. Anyway, I mean, that would not even have been a conversation. What, 5 years ago? It seems like a kind of a post-COVID with a shortage, with a disruption in supply and demand for employment. Also feels like that tide has shifted And I was sort of surprised that you got that response that vociferous from that many people. It was wild. Yeah.
It was wild. I was astonished. And Brett, you should get Twitter just to read some of these comments, because people are still at war with each other. I'm like, that's not going to get involved. People are in the comments.
Twitter, I'm just not super active on it, but this will be something wild. I got to do.
It came completely unhinged. Sure. Yeah, it's been amazing. Yeah, it's been, and it keeps coming up because people are like retweeting it and saying, oh, you know, here's my opinion on this issue. I'm like, it's not a issue. How else am I going to? Well, we're hiring school bus drivers. Brett, are you a good school bus driver? Yeah, I'm great at driving school buses. Cool. Would you mind sharing us? Could you drive a school bus for us? We just make sure you know.
Anger and the more talking that happens with this, the more applicants you're going to see.
Yeah.
It's going to be put out there much wider, mm-hmm. and you're going to get a lot more qualified folks than had this never happened.
Yeah, I agree. So it's been a fun 48 hours. Anyway, what's up with you, gents?
Well, I was hosted in Las Vegas last week by some real estate guys at the Sphere, which is the new kind of only $2.3 billion music venue, which was a completely different experience. Overwhelming, and it should be for $2.3 billion, I would say. I did, yeah. So I did two of the four nights, which was plenty for an old
fish out there, right? So Fish just played.
That only happened once.
47 minute long song.
It was good. It'll be interesting to see how that thing plays out, because it would be a lot of work to play there, just given the 3.5 acres of LED screens behind the stage and above the stage. But it was a very, very cool experience, I would say.
You know, I thought of you on my drive home from Texas. I was listening to some Grateful Dead, and I haven't listened to the Grateful Dead in a very long time. And of course, to the Grateful Dead and Fish. And the more I listened, the more I realized, I don't know that I actually ever really loved the Grateful Dead. I think I just love smoking weed. And now that I don't smoke as much weed, this is like, you can't go back and meet your heroes. I was a little bummed out. I heard, you know, Friend of the Devil and Box of Rain. I was like,
it's amazing what a little bit of age does to you.
The way I thought
perspective
it was
is what we call that, Elliot. Sorry, Eric. I didn't mean to cover you there.
Yeah,
man.
But sounds awesome. I'm glad you had fun.
I was in LA,
what's new in your world?
A fantastic property you guys probably know out there called The Grove. That's a wonderful, you know, Disney scale development by Rick Caruso, and really changed the landscape of the Third and Fairfax area, probably the highest producing shopping center in the country, or, you know, top handful of them. The cool thing that I learned was that the property's on a ground lease. And so I was just doing the math. The rents there is probably 300,000 square feet of ground level space. Rents there are $300 a square foot ish. Call it $90 million of, it's two story, but wow. scratch the upper floors. Yeah. $90 million of NOI owned by a family who also owns the property next door, an old school 1930s era farmer's market. Going through the math in my head. Yeah.
I've been out there. It's awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. So 60,000, my guess is that's maybe 60,000 square feet. Those rents are probably $200 a foot. Call that they own outright, 12 million NOI, and then 90 next door. That, you know, they're not getting that in ground rent payments next year, but someday they will be. Love everything about it.
Yeah, that place is awesome. My daughter and I went there. We went out for the Taylor Swift concerts in August, and we ended up there one day. And it's an impressive development from top to bottom, I'd say.
Yeah, fantastic. Also, the they've got an on-site office, the Gilmore family, they've got an on-site office there that looks like a, you got to drive around the corner, but it's almost like having a ranch on the property, hidden gate down a back alley. Fantastic. Love everything about Los Angeles. Not going to lie. What do we got going today, Brett?
So today I thought just kind of in from the audience perspective, maybe a different asset class. And so I've selected a deal called Blandford Villas, which is outside of Savannah, and it's a build for rent community. So I think some of the listeners hopefully have kind of heard about this build for rent product or asset class, which is multifamily rental product, but it's townhomes, detached single family homes. And there is a lot of institutional capital that is hyper focused on figuring this out for a variety of reasons. So I thought this one might be a good one for us to touch on today. Hope the audience, we're all learning in this space, I would tell you. So I'd say we're, you know, still in the early innings here, if we're in the first inning or the second inning. And actually moderated a panel last week with some institutional capital at an event that we were hosting in Sea Island. And again, it's been wildly interesting if you're in the broker role, because you don't, there's not a lot of answers. So it's great to be able to say, I don't know. But personally, and granted, we've got a dog in the fight here. I mean, I do think this is here to stay. And there'll be a lot more learning lessons along the way here in the build for rent industry.
Well, let's do it.
So
sure.
Yeah. Run us through it. You want to pull this up on the screen, or I'm kind of taking a look here. If you can't, I'm happy to pull it up. Let
me pull this thing up here. Did that show up, guys?
No.
Oh, so I'm doing great.
No.
Yeah, you're doing great, Brett. Ah, look at this. It's like my so golf game. Sometimes the second guy's better.
Here we go.
There we go. Now we're cooking with gas. So this is, again, a deal that's about 20 miles outside of Savannah, Georgia. And, you know, again, this is all of this product is new, just given that this is a relatively new asset class. I'm sure Elliot and Eric, you guys have seen townhome product or carriage product on existing multifamily or, you know, within existing multifamily or you know, mixed use communities. But there's a lot of, and again, for the audience, there are a lot of developers and home builders that are building purpose-built communities for rental. And so, you know, again, I think everybody out there is lived in an apartment or have a buddy that they've hung out with an apartment. And so this space, I think, is really just catering towards the matriculation of the U.S. population. I don't really even know what matriculation means. I just ripped that line off from somebody else, which is what you do in the real estate business. But the aging demographic of the U.S. population, starting families, looking for more space. And so the natural progression here, or the thesis that where things stand today, which I think is being proven out, is this is not main and main locations, which we've talked about on some prior podcasts, but you tend to be in second or third ring locations outside of hopefully bigger cities. And what I did here last week at the conference was the average age in build for rent communities is 43 years old. So that kind of does jive with the overall thesis. And I think maybe to start with here too, which I think is very beneficial, is just kind of defining the nomenclature of build for rent, which is important, and maybe even the history. So a lot of private equity and hedge funds were acquiring one-off single family homes that were in foreclosure during the great financial crisis, let's say in 2009 through 2011, and just kind of saying, we'll buy these that we know is a good deal, and we'll figure it out as we go. And so as we've evolved from, you know, over the last 15 years, again, there's these communities that are being purpose built for rentals. And then you've got some nuances within the asset class there. And so you've got detached single family homes that are individually platted, and you've got individually platted townhomes, which I would define as build for rent. And so then you've got the kind of hybrid there would be kind of cottage product or horizontal multifamily, which is lower density multifamily, but all on a single plat, which we'll get into a little bit later why that's important. And then what was going on in the post GFC, the single family rental space, which were groups buying homes off MLS that are not contiguous. So build for rent would be all contiguous, individually platted cottages and horizontal multifamily, or again, one in the same would be contiguous, but all in a single plat. And then the SFR or single family rentals would be non-contiguous and not really geographically focused, I would say, just in a way of defining kind of what the space is. I'm trying.
So
it's 20 miles outside of
Rincon, Georgia,
of Savannah. And so, again, that's what we see a lot. So these one question we get on every one of these deals that we work on is this seems like it's in the middle of nowhere. And I think that just boils down to a math exercise where if this was a better location or a more main to main location, a multifamily developer would be putting 25 to 30 units an acre on it versus, you know, detached single family, you're probably putting four homes per acre, or townhomes, you're probably putting somewhere between 8 and 12. So just the math exercise, the multifamily guys could just pay a lot more for these sites.
Yeah. So this is,
I think
for people following along, how many is this? 32 units. Oh, sorry. It says right there. Sorry. 16 units. I was looking three bed, 2.5 bath. So it's all the same.
We want to scroll down a little bit.
Three bed, 2.5 bath.
Yeah. This is all townhome products. So maybe what we can do
townhouse.
Here is, yeah, pull the gallery up for everybody and just, I mean, I think you guys, the audience, I'm trying to.
You're not sharing the screen anymore.
I couldn't scroll down on, let's I guess we're back, right back to where we were. Oh, so that's working, right, in terms of scrolling down. Okay. So there's just a little bit more info on it. So, got here, 16 townhomes. This was built in 2020. And the investment highlights are one of the comments in here is that the current owner bought these from the builder, which makes sense. And you know, again, there's some interesting dynamics here, obviously much bigger layouts. And so I thought it might be good to kind of talk about maybe some of the differences between conventional multifamily and the build for rent product, which I think, again, the biggest one would be how people are thinking about amenities. Because, again, going back to the comment that I firmly believe in, Elliot and Eric, I'd be interested to get your thoughts about this on a newer conventional multi-housing deal. I think the decision to rent there is really made when you walk in the clubhouse and have the initial conversation with the leasing team, and you can see the amenities, see the pool. And I think the unit finishes and layout of the units is secondary to kind of the amenity package. And I think it's kind of completely different for build for rent. But, you know, Elliot and Eric, what are your thoughts about just kind of, you know, resident psychology or potential resident psychology and conventional multifamily?
These all seem to me like a financing mechanism, somebody that maybe there's some temporary users of these, but it seems like here's a way if you can't get a mortgage and you want to have some semblance of single family type life, here's a way to afford it. And then when I look at these things that are kind of second tier locations and second tier markets, my mind first goes to here's $4,600,000. The land here's probably not worth much. How hard would it be to take $4,600,000 and recreate something like this?
Right.
My sense is not that hard. I don't know. I know Savannah, but I don't know Rincon. I don't know this. I just feel like these kinds of things, can you go build 18 townhome units in a second tier American, outside of a second tier American city? I think the moat with these kind of products is next to nothing.
Sure.
That's always the thing that gets me. Like if I build this and it goes, as soon as it goes well, I'm going to have 100 competitors.
Eric, I think you touched on an interesting point Brett and I have chatted about this before, but there's a little bit of kind of what should the rent be? What cap rate are you buying it at? But the question that I always ask of why do people want to live here in this submarket? Aren't you really looking at what Correct. Are the cost of home ownership in this submarket? And what's that monthly burn? Let's say you put 10% or 20% down, principal, interest, taxes, whatever. There's some monthly nut that if you are able to swing that, you're going to buy a home. And so you need to be at a discount to that. So you're tracking, it feels like you're tracking the mortgage rate and the single family home market almost more than you're tracking the apartment market, because I think you're living here if you want the home type experience, but for one reason or another, either you're here temporarily or you're not able to afford a home yet or a whole host of different reasons. And so it's a strange pricing model to me, because Brett, can you talk a little bit about how much single family home pricing?
I think that is one of the biggest differences from a valuation perspective from conventional multi to build for rent. Is if you're buying a 300 unit multifamily community and you pick the city, you're valuing it based on the income approach, or you're putting a cap rate on the net operating income or NOI. And here, that is obviously a very important part of the exercise, but Elliot touched on it. I firmly believe that the vast majority of groups buying build for rent today want to convince themselves they're buying at some level of discount, kind of back of the napkin, what we assume is kind of a 10 to 15% discount to what a retail user could go and buy the same home for across the street or in the neighborhood or in the city. So I think walking into an investment committee meeting today and saying, hey, we're buying these at a 10 to 15% discount is really, really critical in order to kind of garner support from the buy side. And so the cap rate tends to be higher on these build for rent deals in a conventional multifamily deal. And what's really interesting is the first one we worked on was during the go-go days, I would say, in late 2020, or maybe it was late 2021. And, we're kind of screwing around with the model and we're like, man, I mean, a lot of multifamily products trading for 3.5% cap rate. And this deal we were kind of penciling out to like a 4.5% cap rate. So, I mean, it's offensively high. But at the same time, when you toggle through what we were just talking about, the price per pound was offensively high as well. So there is a kind of cap rate premium, or you're going to buy a deal that has a wider cap rate than a conventional multifamily deal. But because, again, I think that's just one of the big nuances between build for rent and conventional multifamily.
So why on earth would you want to own this?
I think that it's an interesting, there's not one group we've talked to that there's been probably $12 or $13 billion at least raised around the whole build for rent thesis. And there's not one group that we've talked to that kind of said, hey, we've found it exponentially easier to get money out the door than what we thought. It's been the complete opposite of that, where we never would have thought it would have been this hard to spend $1 billion. And that's there's a couple of reasons for that. Everyone's buy box has changed, is rapidly evolving and has continued to rapidly evolve. So a lot of folks we talk to say we need to be in main-to-main locations and good school districts. And you're going to go, okay, tell me more. And you're like, yeah, that just doesn't exist in build for rent. So, I think you've had a ton of money raised around the thesis of build for rent that just people are buying information at this point.
Wouldn't this and those types of buyers, the big buyers are not going to do something like this, a $4.5 million deal outside of Savannah.
Yes. So what groups are really looking for is geographical right. scale here. So coming in and running a 16 unit deal where you don't own anything else in the Savannah market is a really challenging operation. So what we've seen is a lot of groups are looking to acquire multiple communities. These communities tend to be, I'd say, let's just say 50 to 100 units, depending on product type. So that's a much, it's a third to, 20% of what a conventional multi-housing deal would be. And so you're really looking to aggregate as many of these as you can, because you want to operate them as efficiently as possible. And a 50 unit deal obviously is not as efficient to operate as a 300 unit conventional multifamily deal.
I think this kind of deal works for a contractor guy with a truck that got this property from his brother-in-law for $100,000, built this for $2 million. His son is the manager and cuts the grass, and he's making 16% on his money with a bank loan.
I think that is a very good assessment, I think, on who plays on this deal. I totally agree with that. What are your thoughts there, Elliot?
So I'm frantically trying to get to some semblance of a financial analysis here. And current mortgage rates are, looks like 7.5%, 7.75%. And so if you're buying this deal, one of the things I want to think about is I want to know the average, because I'm going to ask Eric how much he would pay for this with this information. So if we assume that you can buy a single family home in Rincon, Georgia for, mm-hmm. let's say, $325,000, and you're maybe not putting any money down, or let's say you're putting $25,000 down. So now your payment is $300,000. If that's true, your monthly payment with no taxes mm-hmm. at all looks to be $2,098. You add taxes, utilities, some other stuff. Well, you have utilities here that you have to pay, but if you add taxes and probably insurance, maybe you're looking at $2,400 a month for a single family home. So let's assume you wanted to buy a single family home. You're looking at a monthly nut around $2,400, $2,500 a month. And if that's true, then what are the rents here? Looks like right, it's saying right here, along with these upgrades, average rent is $2,000. Okay. So you've got a maybe a $450 to a $500 discount monthly nut to a thing that you don't own versus a thing that you would own. But Eric, how comfortable, how much cushion do you want between the average single family home monthly spend and your target rent? And there, neither one of us know the answer.
I don't want this under any circumstance. I think. I think it makes sense if you're the builder of this, or if there was some, you know, ridiculous discount buying it from a bank under duress or something like that. But having kind of a, you know, unattractive, cheap building in a second tier location where your money's made on raising the rents on people looking to spend less is just a tough business proposition. So you'd have to at a sustainable discount for kind of forever. So, you know, to me, I wouldn't get out of bed.
Right. There's a ceiling on the rent.
If this was a 10 cap, I'd maybe start to think about it. And I think I'm an outlier, but there's plenty of people that would do it for less than that. But I think if you look at the intrinsics of this thing and the feeble barriers to entry that a product like this has, you're always going to be pushing a rock uphill.
Yeah, and you're actually hoping that the 10-year doesn't go down because the cost of home ownership gets more affordable. You're losing, I assume here, you're losing most of your renters to home ownership, right? They're either moving out of the market and they were not going to ever be there long term. That's probably 20% of your population is transient but doesn't want to be in an apartment. And then the other 80% is probably thinking along the lines of home ownership and when does that make sense for us? And if rates go down.
And I think this kind of product, I think the $300,000 example that you used, I don't have enough interest to go down this research hole, but I would think you could replace a townhome of this location and quality for $175,000. And even if it's $200,000, that all the reasons for this evaporate.
Right. So so the challenge in your mind is that you're paying essentially above replacement cost here at this number, and you don't have any moat. You're probably surrounded by other plots of land that this ostensibly could work for. And so if you're doing well, Brett's going to show up and build a slightly newer, slightly nicer product across the street.
That as soon as you make money, word gets out and five more get built. And you're the one that's left with the boat anchor around your neck of repairs and maintenance for the next 20 years and no rental.
All right. Well, let's take even if we're going to pretend, let's take a slightly more optimistic view of this, because someone is probably considering investing in these things. And there's got to be a few out there that are worth it. There's some market clearing price where even you're a buyer. And for you, it's a 10 cap. Maybe Eric, it's a 9 cap, or Brett is a 9 cap. But if you're trying to get your arms around one of these, what are some of the other variables that we're not thinking about here, Brett? We're thinking about school districts, which is huge for people who are moving in. You're thinking about discount to the single family home market. Perhaps you're looking at some apartment comps. What are other things that you're trying to check the box on this build for rent product that feels like a compelling reason for people to move there? Is it a community center? Is it better amenities for the homeowners? Is it proximity to transit? Like,
yeah. So I think here what you've got are people that are moving in. I think you guys touched on absolutely one of the more critical dynamics here, where you're kind of saying, all right, if folks are going to pay $2,000 a month, what else could they get? I mean, how much does home ownership cost? And I agree with that. So let's just say it's $2,400, but you've also got the upkeep of it. If the air conditioning breaks, you're got on the hook for that. And so you've got to have some pretty a decent chunk of change squirreled away to kind of address any of those things. If you're buying a brand new home, you wouldn't expect that. But the joys of home ownership, we all know that stuff comes up. And so, you know, I think in terms of amenities here, I firmly believe that the biggest amenity in these communities is the fact that you're on grade without neighbors above you. Here in townhome product, you got neighbors behind you, but I think it's the fenced in backyard or some sort of outdoor amenity space for, let's just hang out with the 43-year-old comment with potentially kids. And then most of these communities, the lawn care and repairs and maintenance are included in your rent, just like it would be at an apartment. So I personally don't think amenities are a huge deal on a 16 or a 75 unit built for rent community. But I think when you get bigger, you've got to be thoughtful about that. And shifting gears a little bit too here, I'd say from my perspective, the for sale home arena or industry has been unbelievably resilient in the face of a pretty rapid increase in interest rates over the last few years, which I think defies conventional wisdom. And the existing home sale arena is non-existent, because I think 80% of the U.S. population has an interest rate below 5%. And I think it's something like 95% have an interest rate below 6%. So those folks financially would not be motivated to sell. So if you are buying a new home, you're having to go to some of these similar type locations. And I think residents are saying, I don't want to put down a down payment and you know, kind of be tethered to this secondary or tertiary location outside of Savannah or Orlando, or you pick the city. So I think some folks are saying, I'm fine renting. I like the product type. I'm fine renting in this location, but I'm not sure I want to spend $325,000 to be here for 10 years or whatever the number is.
Warren Buffett had a thing once where he said that the most attractive investment that he could think of would be a huge portfolio of single family homes if there was someone that would manage it. And I think that's right. How, you know, the idea of that is everybody's got to live somewhere. And if you were clipping some of the economics off of that necessary function of life and could do it at scale and had someone to manage it, that's a terrific business.
Absolutely.
The nuance comes with, what are you paying for that? And what is the operating leverage that you might have? So these, I think the build to rent idea came around people buying, you know, disparate single family homes after the GFC and realizing, wow, what a pain in the ass these things are to buy at scale and then to manage. And so then that sort of led to the idea of, well, what if we built our own and created a community of these things? I think that all jives. And having homes that are feel like single family and are sized for a actual family, but are for rent. There's a subset of the world that wants that. Either they're transitioning or moving out of their house to upgrade it, or they're in a new city. Plenty of reasons for that kind of thing. But I think a lot of that benefit comes just as it does with multifamily in having the scale where you can have a manager. Who's going to run this thing? Does it say?
So they make a comment at the bottom of the investment highlights section, which says ability to lock in our current property manager will stay on for 5% of gross rents. But Eric, you hit the nail on the head from our perspective. It's the learning lessons that still need to be figured out on the operation side of the equation. I mean, you can't afford to have somebody on site here on a 16 unit community. But you've got obviously to meet resident needs from a day-to-day operation standpoint. So I think that's going to be mission critical for everybody. And how do you do that effectively?
And these crappy buildings and the hot water heaters and the roof and the hurricanes and the everything about you blink in Savannah and you're covered in mold. Running this type of a building is no joke. You can watch the depreciation happening on buildings like this.
Yeah, hard to disagree with that comment.
So with this deal and with a lot of them, because they're brand new, there's no value add opportunity. There's no thing that you can do that's going to improve this asset. So what you're buying is yield, and you're buying yield hopefully that
right.
accounts for whatever the risk you're taking is. And so the 10-year today is 4.65.
I just delete those emails when they come in.
Great. So maybe the 10-year is at 4.7 now, but what right. is the appropriate spread above the risk-free rate for something generally like this? Because you're just buying yield, right? You can't really improve it. You can't raise the rents too much because people will move out and buy a single family home. There's some natural ceiling on the rent. And so you're really what you pay here matters a great deal. What's the yield? What's the spread above the 10-year that you want on your stabilized yield on cost to buy something like this? Eric, you talked about a 10 cap. So you're thinking 600 bips or 500 bips of spread?
I would think so, because that yield is, if you look at this 6% cap rate, without even scrolling through it, I can't imagine that that's real once you figure in the repairs and maintenance and management of this product, especially over a long
Eric, are you suggesting that the brokers took an optimistic view of operations to justify this purchase price? I'm floored to hear this.
But I think, and that another thing that happens over long periods of time, anybody that's ever owned old buildings, things change. If you want to own something for 20 years, depreciation is real. And if you only consider the first few years of ownership in calculating that, you end up getting smoked on these things. This is the type, if you could lock in, if you could be real about the management, if you could be real about the repairs and maintenance, and have this at a what would really be a 10 cap, that'd be a great thing to own. Because you're also setting your cost, you've fixed a basis that's probably pretty attractive. The fact of the matter is, there's no way this sells at a 10 cap, and somebody's going to buy it probably pretty close to this asking.
Yeah, I think there's one other part that I'd layer into the valuation exercise, or maybe even more the exit strategy here. If you're convinced you're getting, let's just say, a 15% discount buying it at this price at a 6 cap, and you subscribe to the thesis that there's going to be a massive undersupply issue for residential housing in the United States over the next 5 years, let's say, and home pricing goes up 10% from today's retail values, then within 5 years, you've made potentially a 25% increase in your value, buying at a 15% discount plus a 10% increase in current retail pricing. So I think there's a lot of groups are thinking about this as potential optionality around the exit strategy, whereas, hey, we're going to cash flow this for 5 years, but we have the option to sell these off one by one 5 years from now. I don't think that's happened to date, or I'm not aware of many of those situations, but I think that's maybe a way to kind of, you know, have a different lens of perspective in terms of kind of the investment thesis here.
And I think.
Right. But we're still back to Eric's earlier point of then you really have to know what it costs to build this thing, because you, if the goal is a sell through, then you've got to make sure you're buying it at a number where it makes sense to buy your thing for $325 a unit instead of the new thing for $300 a unit. So, yeah, I think Eric's dead on with that. You got to spend a ton of time figuring out what construction costs are for this kind of thing. And he might be right. It could be $170 a door. So paying $290 for the finished product seems maybe.
And then imagine going down the road of we're going to sell these off, and then you're left with like four of them. And your office is in Boston.
Yeah. Right. Yep.
And you can't scrape these off your shoe.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Houston. We got a problem then. Yeah. If we had answers to any of these questions, what fun would it be on the journey then?
Yeah.
But I think the big issue with these types of things is if I was going to do this, I was going to spend $4,650,000 to own this. Why wouldn't I build it?
I think that's the thesis that everybody's taking. Replacement cost or reproduction cost, yeah. I think, is critical in anything in commercial real estate today.
Yeah.
Hey, Brett, there's something I see here on investment highlights. It's this last little bullet point, which they kind of slip in there. It says ability to lock in the current taxes until 2027.
So I think that's a South Carolina or a Georgia specific thing. And I don't want to, Eric, I believe it's something to do with that.
Every 5 years they reassess. Yeah. That you got to get very comfortable around that one too, because they're going to know that there was a sale. And if your current assessed value is $1 million and it trades for 4.6, you're going to have some explaining to do come tax time. So you're going to have to make sure you underwrite that correctly. So perhaps that six gap might not actually be a six gap.
Taxes and insurance are a big part of the math equation. What the hell do I know?
Yeah.
So Eric's.
All right, gents, anything else on this one?
Eric's not a buyer. I don't think Elliot's a buyer of the six cap either. So again, yeah, you can buy a lot of conventional multi for, you can buy publicly traded REITs for north of that on an implied cap rate basis.
You know what I say about Airbnb, and I say to those idiots all the time, is they have mastered all of the bullshit that comes along with running a hotel with none of the scale that comes from running a hotel. And that's a little bit of what's going on here. You've sort of got an apartment complex. It's kind of homes. You have 16 families who want shit from you on a regular basis, but that building won't support the necessary infrastructure to service that. So you've got this weird hodgepodge of part-time people, or you're, like Eric said, your brother is helping you take care of it in exchange for a discount on one of the units. It feels inefficient. It feels like the right thing for a local operator who's going to live in one of the units and run it. Who knows? But I am not a buyer. And I think that there is a bullshit premium associated with 16 units of anything, and your cap rate should trade tighter.
How about if it was 100 units? Does that change the...
Yeah. Well, because with 100 units, you can have a full-time office person who's dealing with issues. You have a full-time maintenance guy, and that's enough scale to support itself. But this doesn't support itself. This requires me to do something. So that 6% assumes that my cost of dealing with it is zero, but that's not correct.
Imagine, and take this, like, you're doing this for your own self. You know, it's easy to pontificate about some other person buying these things, but say this was actually you, Brett. And the incremental pain in the ass in your life of owning this, how you would deal with that on a monthly basis. Did that rent get collected? I wonder if that, when is that tax bill due? Oh, no. Wow. We've got a, oh, there's a roof on unit 7. Oh, the people were in a fight in units 8 and 9. This is horrible. What would you pay not to have that incremental pain in the ass?
The famous metric of, yeah, I call that return on hassle.
I like it.
It's one of my favorite metrics.
Some post-it notes on the counter. 9, 10 cap, the tax payment this month.
It's like a beautiful mind in Brett's office trying to run his brokerage firm.
And it's not that beautiful of a mind as everybody knows at this point.
Yeah. And what is that premium? Now, this kind of thing, you got to wait 20 or 30 years for black swans. But this is the kind of product that in the early 90s, you know, somebody would have bought for $300,000. And then, is saying it was a similar price, you know, that these kind of things, when a hurricane happens, financial markets hurricane happens, these kind of things are the ones that can sell like ridiculously cheap. And then that would be fun. You know, you could deal with the hassle of this thing. If instead of 4.6 million, you bought it for $300,000 or $400,000.
Yeah.
But these aren't those times.
Agreed. Agreed.
All right. You had enough.
All right, gents. Yeah. I think we've reached some semblance of a conclusion. You guys got any closing notes? I'd say it
continues to be wildly interesting. And again, where there's capital or liquidity, there will be transactions that happen. And again, what I've kind of said about the build for rent space, when I'm asked to moderate panels or speak on panels, and when they kind of say, do you have any closing comments, I kind of joke and I say, well, I'm joking, but I'm not really joking. This is the most well-funded R&D experiment in commercial real estate history. And I think it checks a lot of the boxes in terms of, yeah, does this make sense at a high level? But as we talked about on the podcast today, there's going to be a lot of nuances. What I kind of coin is learning lessons along the way for everybody, which is exciting and a good place to be if you're a knucklehead broker.
Yeah, it's a concept. It's just not this one.
Yep. Fair enough. We'll make sure we don't send you this one. Well, this isn't our listing, but the other ones we'll send you, Eric, and then we'll have the six. Yeah. Do I have a deal for you, Eric?
Well, we'll only send you the good deals, Eric.